Hey everyone, welcome back to the 443 Security Simplified. I'm your host, Mark LaLiberty, and joined with me today is...
Sorry, I was trying to think of something funny to say.
That's Corey Knockreiner. In today's episode, we've got a few different news topics from the authors of the Mirai botnet being sentenced, and an update to Chrome and Firefox that may cause, 35,000 websites to break next month. Then we'll jump into our main piece on sophisticated cyber attacks. Stay tuned, and let's jump right in. Let's jump into the news.
Reporting from Seattle, downtown, I'm Corey Knockreiner, and I'm with Mark LaLiberté. What's in the InfoSec security news, Mark?
Guess how many hours of sleep Corey and I got last night.
You didn't sleep either?
Oh, it was the Sounders match, and it was frustrating.
The Timbers did good.
Get out. In this week's news, the authors of the Mirai botnet were sentenced.
Woohoo!
Do you know what the Mirai botnet is, Mr. Corey?
Sounds like a anime.
I think it was named after...
I think I have like 6 videos on the Mirai botnet. It's all we talked about mid-2016 on.
I mean, it was pretty hardcore. Infected like a couple 100,000 devices, took down Brian Krebs's website, OVH, ruined all of my productivity one day when it took down Dyn, which took out Reddit and Twitter.
Half of the East Coast big domains for 4 hours.
It was pretty rough. And so,
to be honest, I'm not joking about it. It really is actually kind of a groundbreaking botnet in that a lot of us, I mean, you've heard us talk, me and Mark talk about IoT security all the time. But even 5 years ago, IoT security was a thing in security researchers' minds, but there wasn't really any kind of weaponized or real-world attack that leveraged IoT. And I would say, other than rumors of smart fridges or smart TVs attacking people, Mirai was the first real concrete evidence of IoT being used in attacks.
And it wasn't actually super sophisticated either.
Oh God, it was simple.
It literally had a list of 61 hard-coded usernames and passwords. And if it discovered open telnet or SSH on the internet.
Before even the hard-coded telnet, to me is the SSH stuff was rare. It was telnet on freaking webcams and DVRs. Can you imagine who the heck leaves devices on the internet with telnet?
A couple 100,000 people, apparently.
Yeah, oops.
But it was very damaging despite its lack of sophistication. It shattered records for denial of service attacks at the time. And I think we were only just recently surpassing those records just a few months ago with
DNS amplification. It was Memcast.
Yep.
Yeah. But I think the first one that we were aware of in the States was the Krebs one, which I think was 620 gigabits per 20.
Gigabits per second.
But then OVH, which I always get it mixed up. I think even though we heard about Brian Krebs first, I think OVH, the hosting company, happened the day before, and that was pretty huge.
A terabit per second. Like, I don't care what DDoS protections you have in place. If you're hit with a terabit per second of traffic, you're going to have a rough day.
Your ISP is going to have a rough day and will be mad at you.
Exactly.
As, by the way, Brian Krebs learned when I think it was Akamai was giving him free hosting and they dropped his site. I'll be polite. They dropped his site after this and he had to go to Google, I think.
Yeah. I mean, understandable. Can't imagine how much money that cost to mitigate that large of an attack.
But, and all their other companies that were, kind of side damage.
Yep. And it obviously hit a nerve with Krebs. He put in 4 months to research and track down exactly who he thought the author of Mirai was.
He found a dude, man.
He found him.
I mean, the reason he should get a lot of credit is, besides knowing his security stuff, he is a good old school investigative journalist, which is pretty much the same as a PI in my book.
Yeah, he wrote a very, very long article where he detailed how he tracked down exactly who he thought wrote the Mirai botnet. And it turns out he got one of the guys. It was a gentleman, I guess we can call him, named Paras Jha, who was a student
at the
time.
One of my 6 videos.
Yeah. And he and a few others wrote this botnet for several reasons. They said something like...
Gaming to start, right? I mean, wasn't this guy at one point running, was it Minecraft or something? He had servers that he was doing some illicit stuff with, gaming servers.
Yeah, but they turn to crime even more so, trying to extort companies for protection money, mafia style.
Yeah.
And take down people they disagreed with, which is why he went after Krebs, arguably. But last December, Paras and a few others were indicted and actually pled guilty rather quickly to charges relating to creating the botnet. And it wasn't until just this last week when they were finally sentenced to 5 years of probation and 2,500 hours of community service.
That's kind of a little hand slap, man. That's not that big a deal. I mean, to me, even worse than some of the attacks they did is the fact that to kind of hide it, to send the signal or the dog scent off him, they released the source code from Mirai.
Right.
It's why all of us have it nowadays. And it's why some pretty significant threat actors have, you know, bots based on it. So I guess he's a kid. You don't want him to lose his life, but it seems like a little teeny hand slap.
Yeah. Apparently, they were very lenient at the request of the FBI
and the
Department of Justice. They specifically said that they've been working with them, actually being very helpful with over 1,000 hours already donated to the FBI to track down other attackers. And this is actually a pretty relatively common trend in terms of turning...
It started even way back in the 90s. Yeah.
Yeah. In terms of turning black hat hackers into law enforcement consultants.
Snitches get stitches, Mark.
That's a good segue into another
one. Remember that when the FBI calls you. You don't know me.
Everyone's probably heard of Adrian Lamo by now, the homeless hacker. He's actually rather controversial in the hacker space for helping law enforcement track down and catch Chelsea Manning, who leaked a bunch of sensitive documents from the U.S. government. Another one's Frank Abagnale, the Catch Me If You Can guy. He got out of prison early for helping the FBI investigate fraud and scam artists. And I mean, he's one of the best fraud slash scam artists that ever walked the earth. So you can see why you can see why law enforcement will want to work with these kinds of people.
Yeah, another guy is his alias on IRC and online was Sabu, but later on he is found to be kind of a New York resident named Hector Xavier Monsegur. I don't know how to pronounce his last name, so that's my best guess. But anyways, the nerds out there, the old nerds like me, will remember LulzSec, a kind of offshoot of Anonymous that decided to do anonymous random hacking for the lulz, which means the giggles. They just were doing it for fun. Did lots of things like intercept calls between Five Eyes and stuff like that. But eventually, Sabu was found by the FBI. And then rather than just put him in jail immediately, they made him keep up the Sabu appearance and turned him into an informant for like 10 months. I think, you know, 4 months into it, a lot of people kind of realized he is an informant, but another one that they kind of turned and used before actually prosecuting him.
Really interesting stuff. And hopefully they're basically kids. Hopefully these three kids behind the Mirai botnet.
I wonder if it's a kid's thing. Like, to me, there was a time period where really in the 80s, 90s, when it was freaking and stuff, a lot of the lack of fear in hacking was that you wouldn't really get in trouble. The FBI would just hire you. Mm-hmm. But there's a period of time where true cybercrime happens, where there are bad guys that really steal money or do damage. So I don't think the black hats out there should just assume that they can plead to the FBI because they do something bad. I think I don't know what the level is, but I think there's kind of a level of hackery that they might...
A level of hackery.
Yeah. Or I'm sorry, hacksory.
God.
Let's make up more words.
You got to imagine you have to be pretty skilled at your craft for the FBI to want to throw you a bone, basically, after catching you.
You'd hope. I mean, some of the ones you named were pretty skilled. Sabu, the guy they used as an informant, I don't know how skilled he was.
Or at least well entrenched in the darker circles of the web.
But I would also assume you'd have to have not done anything... too costly, you know, that costs too much money to businesses or really stole.
Are you saying that the FBI isn't going to hire the North Korean hackers that made WannaCry?
Maybe not.
In other news, though, so over the past few years, Symantec as a certificate authority has had several lapses in security when
Who's
it comes
Symantec?
To the CIA
I've never
certs.
Heard of them.
Symantec is more than just an AV company.
Oh.
They, up until, I guess, just recently, were a certificate authority in charge of signing and validating certificates for websites on the internet. They've had a few issues, though, over the past years, which has ultimately led to a ticking down of removing them as a trusted certificate authority from Chrome and Firefox, and I assume all the other browsers here. that's already started, Chrome 66 back in June and Firefox something around the same time.
I did a video warning about that just because they're... I think you'll get to it now, too, but there's quite a few real big sites out there that actually have semantic issue certificates still.
Yep. As of June of this year, or actually, yeah, June of this year, they started removing trust of any certificates issued prior to June of 2017 by Semantic. And now, just around the corner in October, with the release of Chrome 70 and Firefox 63, both of those browsers will now no longer trust any Semantic issued certificate. And as of the end of July, Mozilla actually went and checked and found that still 3.5% of the top 1 million websites on the internet were using Semantic signed certificates. So this is it's a potential time bomb, but it's kind of understandable. I mean, the whole CA certificate thing relies on trust.
Yep.
So if a CA vendor breaks that trust, you've got to...
By the way, for the nerds out there, do know certificates are entirely based on asymmetric cryptography. You've probably heard me and Mark talk about a public-private key pair. Like, I can launch a public-private key for myself, publish the public key to everyone telling it it's for me. I hold on to the private one. And if I actually sign my public key, that's really what a digital certificate is. But the one flaw to that is what's holding Mark back from creating a new public-private key pair, saying, hey, this is Corey's public-private key, and publishing that to the world as me. And really, all a certificate authority is this trusted third party that's supposed to control the certificate creation process, so that when Mark or when Corey wants a certificate, I go to this trusted authority, and they're the ones that ensure to you, the general public, that this key really isn't Corey. It really is Corey, and isn't Mark being somebody that's going to lose his bonus this year.
Hold on, guys. I got to go delete a certificate real quick. there is an organization, I guess, a collective of CA certificate vendors called the Certificate Authority Browser Forum that sets the standards for CAs to follow.
It sounds like some exciting meetings there.
I bet it's absolutely thrilling.
Yep.
But they come up with what's called baseline requirements, things like key length or hashing algorithms that certificate authorities can use. And all of the CAs kind of buy into this and agree to follow along with these baseline requirements.
So what level of security? Like back when MD5 hashes finally got broken, eventually they would say, hey, you can't use that one anymore. You have to use this one or you can't be part of our group.
So some of the strikes against Semantic, I guess they weren't following some of the basics and security from the CA browser forums. They got a few warnings and continued on with their ways. They've also run into issues.
Seems really silly to me because I think we read that key length. It seems trivial to just up your key length. The modern, it's not something that would have caused a lot of heartache, I wouldn't think.
I mean, not many other CA vendors had issues with it, so you got to wonder. They also had problems with actually issuing certificates that they should not have issued, test and example ones to different third parties that were kind of no-no at the time. So, long story short, they are being removed from the trusted CA bundles for all major browsers here, finally starting in October. I think it's like October 18th or 20-something. This is when Chrome's going to launch Chrome 70 and Mozilla right around the corner then, too. So,
I guess that means if you're one of the 35,000 people out there that still have a Semantic certificate, it's time to go change that sucker.
Exactly. If you're not sure if you're running a Semantic certificate, maybe someone else set up whatever encrypted web services you're using, you can check pretty easily. In Chrome, if you just click the little lock, the HTTPS encryption lock, there's a link that shows up for certificates, and it shows a list of the certificate chain for whatever cert you're using for your website. If you see Semantic in there, you're going to have to do some work to replace that. The good news is DigiCert is offering to replace any Semantic certs for free. So definitely something to look into. And then come launch of Chrome and Mozilla Firefox in October, you might need to help troubleshoot some issues with your clients too. They do have specific error messages that are going to show up in the browsers when they encounter a Semantic signed certificate. Chrome's is very specific.
What will it be? These guys screwed up?
Exactly. Yeah. Bad CA. Chrome's error message is cert Semantic legacy. Firefox's is a bit more, I guess
it's very meaningful. Specific.
Yeah.
Everyone could figure it out.
Mozilla PKIX error, additional policy constraint failed.
Makes total sense to me.
You'll remember that one, hopefully, right? either way, if you start seeing certificate errors, you know, that big exclamation point warning sign when you visit an encrypted
website. It's Mark Man in the Middle in you with my certificate, man so in the middle watch you. Out.
Yep, exactly.
Oops, sorry.
Probably nothing to do with this. Probably just me hacking you.
By the way, to be fair to Symantec, it's not the first time CA screwed up. If you're a historical grandpa like me, you probably remember Komodo and DigiNotar. Those guys, I think, eventually got... they're doing certs again now.
Yep, Komodo's back.
But something to watch out for. Can we trust the people that are supposed to be the trusted?
Exactly. And good on Chrome and Mozilla for keeping them honest, at least for now. And with that, I guess we can move on to our main piece. For our main bit today, we wanted to talk about some sophisticated cyber attacks.
Those are the ones that wear like a top hat and have the monocle. I like those guys.
Yeah, exactly. Sophisticated cyber attacks, monocle required. We've actually picked out three. There are many more than just these three. Maybe we can dive into more later. But we feel like we talk a lot about cyber attacks just in general and, you know, common stuff like the Mirai botnet and less sophisticated attacks that require just login and credentials or exploiting some cheap vulnerability. And we don't often dive deep into the more advanced ones that actually exploit a series of 0 days in order to infect devices.
I think there's a handful only of any cyber attacks that literally exploited a number of 0 days. And you'll probably start by talking about one of them.
Yes. I wish I could remember which media outlet decided to call it weaponized Stuxnet. But nowadays...
weaponized Stuxnet?
You haven't heard that? No.
No.
It was tangent time.
What is Stuxnet if it's not weaponized?
Exactly.
The benign one? I'm the little My Little Pony in the field, Stuxnet.
Exactly.
I don't screw up your nuclear centrifuges. I help make Keebler Elf cookies.
Notice how Corey's mind first goes to the My Little Pony Stuxnet. Interesting. Shall we continue with that? No, let's just dive into regular Stuxnet. Stuxnet, you've probably heard several times before, but maybe you don't know the exact details about it. Mostly because the exact details...
Because
still...
no one's talked about it before.
Exactly.
I'm sure they don't have documentaries or anything on it.
Stuxnet.
But if I you lived are... through it, damn it.
Grandpa Corey, come on. Stuxnet was a computer worm back from the late 2000s that was designed to disrupt Iran's nuclear program. Again, this is all allegedly. I don't think anyone's 100% come out and said, yeah, we did this to destroy their weapon program, but this is what it was for.
There's been leaks about the Olympic Games, about the creation of this first weaponized cyber attack stuff specifically to slow down or speed up Iran's denuclearization.
Yep. This was a very sophisticated attack, both at its time and still to this day. It's one of the few malware attacks we've seen that jumps platforms from Windows to basically IoT. It was going after... PLCs. So
I always start with the 4-0 day.
Yeah.
I mean, 0 day, I'm sure our audience knows 0 day is when we don't use the term with malware at the end of it. It typically means a software vulnerability, an exploit or software vulnerability where the vendor behind the software doesn't know about it. And the only reason I want to start by talking about 0 day is 0 day is worth its weight in gold. I guess it doesn't weigh anything, so everything's
anyway. It's worth nothing is what he's trying to say.
0 day is worth a lot of money depending on the flaw. I mean, nowadays researchers can sell like remote routes and iPhones for $1 million. So 0 day, when you have a new vulnerability in either a popular or a targeted product, you're not going to just burn that for any attack. You're going to save that because as soon as you use it, you got to... you realize you're going to lose it.
Yep.
So even seeing 1 0-day exploit out in the wild is usually a significant thing. But for a piece of malware to have 4 different 0-day vulnerabilities in it was mind-blowing, I think, for the malware researchers at the time when we first
Hardcore.
Learned about it.
And it used these 0-day vulnerabilities to help it spread like a worm.
Yeah. Although even before, I mean, the first and biggest, I think, vulnerability it used was the shortcut link one.
Yep.
And that's because, I mean, the government in this case was literally going after a hardened nuclear
system.
Yeah. So they had to get use human intelligence and get some spy guy to bring a USB key in a facility to start this whole thing off.
Yep. So it exploited a zero day and Microsoft's handling of basically removable storage. So USB drives, where when you plug in the USB key with this tainted worm in it, it would automatically infect and install on that system. And that was how they got their foot in the door.
I believe
basically.
It was specifically with a shortcut link. When you put in it wasn't the plug and play USB thing, but it was when you put in USB storage devices, if there were any shortcut files, which are .lnk files in Windows systems, even though it's not launching them, Windows did some parsing of that when you plugged in the USB key, and the flaw in parsing links was enough to get it to exploit code.
And that got their foot in the door. And then from there, they had several other vulnerabilities to now spread on that network that otherwise wouldn't have had internet access.
So to elevate privileges, I think, was one. I think there's even vulnerabilities in some of the more more proprietary software, too.
Yep. It exploited two vulnerabilities to help spread to other systems, both of them using RPC, so remote procedure call. One of them wasn't actually a zero day. It was the same vulnerability used by the Conficker worm 2 years before, but it was still obviously useful. They did have a zero day, though, in RPC, specifically in the printer spooling. So it could send a very carefully crafted print request to a computer that had a shared printer, and it would spread the worm over to that computer, too. And then you mentioned already had zero day vulnerabilities for elevating privileges, because the original worm would only run with the account that it was logged into the computer with when you plugged into the thumb drive. So it needed to get admin or system privileges in order to deal real damage. And then once the worm was on these computers, it would search for a very specific piece of software. You want to go over that?
Oh, yeah, sure. So it was looking for specifically DLLs for a piece of Siemens. Is that how you pronounce the?
We'll go with that.
Siemens 7.
All right. So we look for Siemens 7 software, which is?
Basically, it's software for programming. It's for industrial control systems. Specifically, engineers use this software to program PLCs, programmable logic controllers. And when it found this software, it was specifically infecting this software, because the goal of the so-called government, alleged government, was to actually infect a device, a centrifuge that had a programmable logic controller in it. So they knew those were air-gapped, those weren't networked, so they had to get on some engineer's computer that had the software to kind of flash firmware update or whatever. And that's how they also, Stuxnet also was the first ever PLC rootkit. Because using this software, it could then bounce to load a Trojanized version of the PLC software. And I say rootkit because it was, they knew exactly what brand PLC was used, what the device was used, because they create a rootkit so that as these centrifuges are spinning out of control, normally there's a machine, what do they call them? A human interface device. I think that's what the SCADA folks call it, that show you how your centrifuge is spinning. That should have given a lot of warnings when things started going out of whack. So the code running on the PLC was actually hiding the fact that it was adjusting, spin rates and stuff like that.
And
so lots of first, PLC rootkit being another first.
And the end result of all this was they were able to spin these nuclear centrifuges so rapidly that they basically tore themselves apart. And again, we don't have exact numbers, but it sounds like thousands of them were literally damaged during this attack. So it was very successful at what it was trying to do.
What's interesting about this is even the fact that we know about it, because this is definitely really sophisticated nation state stuff, black ops stuff. And what we didn't talk about is there was a lot of kill switch stuff in this malware too. It was designed to after a certain amount of time just off itself, or to, if I'm not on the right system, I'm just going to, you know, kill the malware off the system. It did a lot to make sure that the malware was supposed to only infect systems that the government wanted it to. But the worm activity apparently got beyond, was it Nance, I think, if I'm pronouncing that right, was the actual nuclear facility in Iran. Mm-hmm. But it got out of Nance. It got to other facilities.
Hit like 200,000 computers.
Yeah,
is what I think I heard.
Which it never should have, and it had kill switch code in it meant to kind of not let that happen, but it was flawed. So it's just the fact that it got out that eventually got traditional. I think it was first a German AV company, followed by Symantec, who did a huge report on it, mm-hmm. that first really analyzed this. But I don't think it was ever meant to see the light of day.
And I guess for us researchers, luckily it did, because it is a cool attack to learn about, at least.
It's definitely cool. I also kind of consider this a Pandora's box moment. You know, whether or not you believe, let's say the ends to remove nuclear weapons from countries that may use them badly might be good ends. I don't know if the means justify the ends. And the reason I say that is, at this point, we pretty much know it's the U.S. government and Israel that did this. But it kind of opened the door to all countries saying, well, okay, this is the new norm. We're all allowed to do this now.
But we know that countries don't interfere with anything using
hacking attempts, never.
Right?
They wouldn't do that.
No, that'd be mean.
So to me, this was Pandora's box giving the green light for countries to start aggressively doing cyber red teams. The other reason I don't like it is I would have actually, while I would have missed learning all this stuff, I think it accelerated cyber criminals' malware evolution as well. And you alluded to this in one way. I mean, Conficker, it used a Conficker flaw, but shortly after this, other botnets started using the USB link vulnerability. The zero day that was released with this started getting used by actual bad guys for criminal means. So I think this really kind of jump-started criminals' idea for how to make more evasive, sophisticated malware.
Yep, especially because just because we now know about a vulnerability and it's patched doesn't mean it's patched everywhere.
Oh, God, we know that. I mean, Conficker spread 7 years after it came out, and I believe it was patched before it even came out.
Yeah, so interesting attack, and I guess the whole getting patched and still being exploited thing is a good segue into our next more sophisticated attack, which would be the NotPetya attack. So background on this one, I guess we can start in April 2017.
Yep.
A hacktivist group called the Shadow Brokers released a ton of hacking tools and exploits from the NSA-affiliated Equation Group.
Yeah.
Allegedly NSA-affiliated Equation Group. I don't want to get us thrown in jail.
It's pretty obvious. Is anyone saying allegedly anymore?
I don't know. I'm going to play it safe. I like my job. Included in this was a vulnerability called Eternal Blue, which was a zero day in Microsoft Windows handling of SMB traffic. So file
sharing. And by the way,
traffic.
There was actually something, I forget the exact, was it five? There was actually a whole eternal class of vulnerabilities. Yep. Blue was the one that we'll be talking about that was used in WannaCry, and we'll talk about NotPetya too.
Yep.
But there's actually more, and a lot of them were SMB related as well.
Exactly. I mean, they're different, technically different vulnerabilities in the same class, but they exploited SMB of different versions and different methods of exploiting it.
And for those that don't know, by the way, SMB stands for server message block, but it's basically Windows file sharing and stuff like that. So sharing, you know, sending files over Windows network.
To Microsoft's credit, they actually patched these zero days rather quickly in April. I think it was only a matter of like a few days or so before we had patches.
It was technically a month before WannaCry they had the patch out. No, I don't know how, before this, if this was allegedly the NSA that leaked this, they were keeping it to themselves. Mm-hmm. But somehow Microsoft did get a heads up a month before, and that's when they patched it.
Yep, so they patched it, and then it was 1 month later after this leak that we saw the Eternal Blue actually weaponized by... Now we know North Korea into the WannaCry attack.
Go watch Guard Predictions.
So WannaCry was the first ransomware to jump into ransom worms, which was another Go Watch Guard and Corey coining that, I suppose.
I'm sure other people had said want to work
take
ransom
the credit
worm at some point. But we predicted it that year.
Exactly. Ransom worm coming from the fact that it was ransomware that no longer required any user interaction to spread.
On the network, yeah.
Yep. It exploited vulnerabilities in SMB, the Eternal Blue ones, to find systems that were vulnerable, and then automatically infect and execute the ransomware on them. WannaCry was a pretty huge deal. It caused quite a bit of damage. Didn't really earn North Korea a whole lot of money. I think like $140,000.
And by the way,
the fact
that we assume or know it's North Korea is it's our intelligence agencies in the U.S. that claim it's North Korea.
Yep.
But for a long time, people weren't sure. It acted like very similar to, criminal ransomware.
Exactly. But 1 month after that then, so now we're in June of 2017, the same vulnerabilities were used in the NotPetya attacks that largely targeted Ukraine, but still had a huge number of victims.
So before I even mention NotPetya, we should mention that Petya, there was a ransomware sample named Petya in the 2016. It looked like all other ransomware. The only differentiation was the fact that it was master boot record malware. It could actually, besides loading in your OS, it would infect part of your master boot record. So presumably, even if you cleaned it up, it wouldn't just encrypt files on your Windows operating system. When you first kind of booted your computer, it wouldn't even get past the master boot record. You'd get a message in text saying, "Hey, we've encrypted your files," and it's literally, at the hard drive level.
The master boot record, by the way, is the file system on your hard drive, the very low-level file system in charge of loading up Windows or whatever operating system you're running. So if you encrypt that, your computer no longer knows where Windows is located or any other boot files, and it's stuck.
And it was kind of like locking malware in that, one, it was still hard encrypting your files, but you couldn't even use your computer until
So NotPetya got its name because it appeared to be largely similar to that.
Yep.
But it was not actually ransomware.
Yeah, it made itself look like ransomware, but it wasn't really trying to be ransomware.
There was absolutely no mechanisms in place to give victims back a key to decrypt their computers, even if they paid. They still said, "Give us money and we'll give you your computer or your files back," but there was nothing.
Nope, they're gone.
Yeah, no way to ever get them back.
So it was technically wiper malware.
Exactly. The initial delivery method, though, was rather interesting.
These guys should have just patched, right? There's lots of automatic patching mechanisms, and I recommend those really strongly. There's nothing ever wrong with those.
Exactly. Yeah, good segue.
Because what are you talking about, Mark?
The delivery
totally
method
sincere.
Was actually from a automatic patching slash upgrade system.
There goes all my advice for the past 20 years.
Yeah. Hear that? Don't listen to Corey. He's full of fake news. So in order to carry out the attack, the attackers, Russia in this case, actually compromised a Ukrainian tax and accounting software tool called MEDOC or MEDOC.
Yep.
Which was hugely popular in Ukraine. I think I saw the last stats were like 90% of all businesses in the Ukraine use this tool in one form or another. So the attackers packaged up NotPetya as an update to the software and pushed it out automatically.
Yep.
So then anyone that had the software installed with automatic updates enabled got a nice little payload of locking ransomware on their computer.
What was interesting, though, that I never really, we never analyzed samples ourselves, but that's how the original, I believe it was pushed as a DLL, but that's how the original went out. But NotPetya escaped the Ukrainian system. It eventually started spreading to other computers because it used basically Eternal Blue, right?
Yep.
So it started with that little accounting that we call it a supply chain hack, but it started spreading on its own beyond that.
AP Moller Maersk, the shipping company, is probably a very good example of this. They were actually using MEDOC on one of their systems, probably in Ukraine or somewhere close by. But it was able to spread across their entire corporate network across the entire world and basically lock every single computer they had. I saw it hit every single domain controller except for one that happened to be offline in Ghana due to a power outage and a failed power backup.
Good job. The one day your disaster recovery or lack thereof saves you.
Exactly. It was hugely damaging to them, though. It was like $300 to $500 million in lost revenue and damages because of this attack. They were offline for an entire week, and it took several months to finally clean up. But this was, another nation-state attack in this case.
Yep. Or allegedly.
Allegedly, yes. I'm sorry. Please don't come after me, Russia. Still another good example of a rather sophisticated attack, though, because it used a supply chain attack. It didn't go directly after the victims. It went after something that all of the victims used.
It's something you trust. And we shortly after this, we don't know if it's nation state, but CCleaner, mm-hmm. a popular Windows app, its update mechanism got infected as well. I think pushed around 3 million installs of malware. So this supply chain stuff, granted, I mean, even a decade ago, there would be Linux package distros that would be infected occasionally. But this seems to be turning into a new trend for sure.
It's, I mean, as defenses are increasing, these bad guys are having to find other ways through them.
And what better way than through some mechanism you trust?
Literally just walking in right through the back door by someone that you trust. I guess we can jump to our third and final sophisticated cyber attack. And this one is Operation Aurora, which was actually a series
like
of attacks.
An anonymous operation.
Exactly. Yeah. Well, no, because it doesn't have the word Chan in it anywhere.
Oh. Yeah, and it needs to be shortened to OP, otherwise it's not cool enough.
It would have been OP Aurora Chan or something along those lines.
Chantology.
And it was actually a series of attacks through most of 2009, I think the latter half of the year. And it targeted mainly major U.S. corporations. Google was the most well-known hit from it. Adobe were victims. It went after a few defense contractors as well. And we know it was linked back to Chinese-backed state hackers through some similarities in malware they found in this with other previously known attacks from these groups. But they were able to steal intellectual property from Google during this attack, which, I mean, you got to imagine IP from Google is probably worth a fair bit of money. Google thinks that the primary goal, though, was to go after Gmail accounts for certain Chinese human rights activists.
This is right around the time, too, you started seeing Google send certain people emails in their Gmail saying that it appears you're being targeted by a nation state, blah, blah, blah.
Yep. And it too, used a zero-day vulnerability in order to carry out this attack. It was a vulnerability in Internet Explorer, a use-after-free vulnerability, which is a type of memory corruption that allows an attacker to exploit and gain code execution in the application. And it was a zero day at the time. We know they used spear phishing emails to trick victims at, I assume, Google to go visit malicious websites, which then had this exploit code running to automatically infect their computers and drop a backdoor onto them. And this kind of, this was what, the late 2009? We're still seeing phishing emails used to this day to carry out attacks. In fact, even more so. The last number I saw actually the other day from KnowBefore, an anti-phishing training company, said it was 90% of all cyber attacks start with a phish these days. So I guess that's a good parallels from back then to here on how attacks continue to use whatever is the easiest method to get in through the front door. They went after Perforce, source code management system for Google. That's how they were able to get their intellectual property. And actually, McAfee did a pretty good investigation of this attack where they went through and checked out a lot of the flaws, I suppose, and default installations of Perforce. Some of these were actually kind of ridiculous looking back after the fact now that they were still in place. Things like, by default, a unauthenticated anonymous user could create another Perforce account on the server. Which sounds
like a good default.
Yeah, exactly.
We're much smarter now, right? With cloud S3 buckets and stuff, we don't have bad defaults anymore.
No. I thought everything in the cloud is secure, right?
Yeah,
they take care of security. Yeah. all the files used by Perforce at the time were stored in clear text. So if you had sensitive information, such as your extremely valuable intellectual property, someone on the system could just read it out of the files and steal it that way. They were also vulnerable to replay attacks with authentication. So issuing requests through Perforce only required an authentication cookie, which was really easy to obtain because all the communications were unencrypted. So if you're on the network, you could grab that cookie and steal whatever you want out of the jar.
And I'd say one theme we're seeing here with the sophisticated attacks, I mean, one, 0 day is obviously involved, but for the two most, for Stuxnet and for Aurora, you know, an attack doesn't just start with one drive-by download in malware. Mm-hmm. It's more about that's the first phase. Then there's a lot of lateral movement. There's enumerating the network from inside out. And while we didn't really we covered it, but we didn't really point it out. But Aurora was all about, lateral movement. It started with the Internet Explorer attack, but obviously these were sophisticated, persistent attackers that could silently stay on one computer for a long time and get to the rest of your network and then eventually learn about your Perforce servers. So in these more sophisticated attacks, it's where APT comes from, Advanced Persistent Threat. And it really is about these smart attackers that it's not just infecting one victim, it's figuring out a way to stay silently on the network for as long as possible and do all these lateral moves that eventually get you to the keys to the kingdom.
Yeah, and we're actually seeing this in ransomware these days too. There was just an article the other day of a ransomware attack that was highly targeted towards a company that the attackers knew quite a bit about. They knew that they would likely pay, I think it was like a $300,000 or $600,000 extortion attempt out of them. It wasn't just a blast and forget type of ransomware attack. They specifically targeted them using advanced malware and then dropped ransomware on their computers.
Maybe even found the servers that had the most value.
Exactly. So, I mean, another instance where increased protections mean the bad guys are having to go to great lengths to get around them. I mean, this was from 2009, but we're probably going to start seeing even more of these style of attacks going forward, too.
And so we're all screwed, right, Mark?
Yeah.
No takeaway? How do we protect ourselves from this?
That's a good question. Turn off your computer and unplug it from the wall.
Scissors.
Cut the cable and pour the bad packets out, right? a layered defense is what I would recommend. A lot of these require exploiting several flaws. And outside of zero days, which are incredibly difficult to protect against, you can at least prevent some of the attack methods by relying on more than one defense mechanism. So if they can get past intrusion prevention services because they're using a zero day, you still might be able to catch the malware payload by looking at its behaviors with a more advanced malware protection suite.
Maybe the machine learning from Intelligent AV here at WatchGuard?
Exactly, yes. Because no protection is perfect and something might eventually make it through, having reporting mechanisms in place to watch for suspicious activity, something like maybe TDR that can help correlate bad activities on a computer with potentially suspicious network traffic.
Yeah, I think your layered is right. I mean, a lot of people don't have all the layers they ought to. And this is why I tend to talk about the defense for this as far as kill chain defenses. You might have heard, if you're out there, something called the cyber kill chain, something that Lockheed Martin first came up with. But people, including me and Mark, have released our takes on it. But essentially, it's different phases of an attack, from the bad guy learning about you to the point where they're actually figuring out your weaknesses, to the point where they've might compile a zero day exploit against you, to installing the malware, to doing the lateral movement and exfiltration of data. But the reason you talk about the kill chain isn't just kind of to make it sound cool, all the steps a hacker does, but it's because each one of those steps has an opportunity for defense. And like you said, even if the exploit phase, if there's some zero-day attack that your current defense can't catch, that doesn't mean like it's the end of the game, because there's still the compromise phase where a payload has to be installed and you have other protections, different types of malware protection, different types of breach detection, even command and control detection that can give you other additional chances to catch some part of the sophisticated attack. And you just need to catch one part of it to kind of be clued in and possibly to, recover. So kill chain defenses, I think we have a ton of webinars on it. Definitely Yep. Look it up at WatchGuard.
And I guess you can leave your computers plugged in the wall then with that, right?
Maybe, although I like the idea of cutting the wire and pouring out the bad packets.
Yeah.
I like adding the bad packets to my coffee. It gives it that nice bitter taste.
This explains a lot.
It's a little chocolatey. Black hat packets make me happy.
Black hat, okay. That's as good of time as ever to end.
What? I was just getting started, Mark.
No, thanks again for listening, everyone. That was it for today's episode. Thanks again for listening. If you enjoyed the episode, please don't forget to rate, review, and subscribe to the podcast. You can find me on Twitter at @XORRO_ and Corey at @SecAdept. Please tweet at us if you have any questions or suggestions for future episodes. Maybe there's another sophisticated cyber attack that you want us to try and break down. with all the sarcasm sprinkled in like magic bad packets. Thanks again for listening, and we will see you again next week.
See ya. Wouldn't want to be